This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of July 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Ethan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Austin sinks into the depths of summer heat.
For the past few years, I feel like it's just been getting hotter.
How new city rules on panhandling may benefit buskers.
Go ahead, drop the hat, play your kazoo, your hand drum, your guitar, and you're off to the races making buckets of cash.
And why does the top of Austin's tallest building look unfinished?
You know, we wanted to do something that revealed a little bit about what was going on at the top.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
I've reached the Austin San Antonio National Weather Service Forecast Office.
This was the first week this year that temperatures in Austin exceeded 100 degrees at Camp Mabry, which is the weather station of record run by the National Weather Service. Of course, with the humidity, we had heat index values even higher. And the weather is forecast to continue through the weekend. So let's talk to someone at the National Weather Service about it.
To speak with a meteorologist, press 2.
I'm Monty Oakes from the National Weather Service office in Austin, San Antonio. I'm a meteorologist. I've been here for 22 years or so.
What are we looking at in terms of heat this weekend?
Well, we have a high-pressure ridge that's basically kind of flat over much of the southern United States. And it's going to basically stay over Texas or have a heavy influence over Texas through the weekend. So temperatures are getting into the 90s to near the lower 100s every day across the region. And so those daily high temperatures without rain is gradually taking out all the moisture in the low levels of the atmosphere. So we're starting to see our high heat index values recess back to more practical values. So we're no longer getting close to those heat advisory conditions we had the last couple of days.
So it's getting hotter but less humid, basically?
Correct.
We are not alone here in Austin. Across the country, people are dealing with a heat wave. As KUT's Mose Bushell reports, it's the kind of thing that's becoming more common because of climate change.
David Kong is standing on a street corner in Austin, starting his shift, holding up a big sign for a real estate company. He's out here all afternoon with the heat index set to hit triple digits. But he's ready.
They say there's no such thing as bad weather, just poor planning.
So he's attached a small portable fan to the sign.
But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Look at it. Check it out. Fan. So good.
Like a lot of people in Austin, he's greeting the heat wave with kind of a shrug. It's not that it's not hot. It's that here, it's like this a lot of the time. Here's how Madeline Ortiz put it. She's a UT student from San Antonio.
Like for the past few years, I feel like it's just been getting hotter. So like, I guess I've gotten acclimated to it. But other than that, it's like just not normal.
She's right. Here, the average annual temperature has risen by 4 degrees in the last four decades. This century, we're averaging 38 triple-digit days, up from 13 last century. Burton Fitzsimmons is the chief meteorologist for Austin's Spectrum News. He says Texas isn't the only place getting hotter.
Extreme heat to you and me, by Austin standards, is a lot different than, let's say, 70 degrees in Anchorage. In fact, they just hit 90 there, all-time high, just a few weeks back. Versus, let's say, New England, where 90 is one thing, but 100 is something else.
He says other places are starting to see the kind of weather Texans have endured for decades, but it's all part of the same thing.
All over, we're seeing these signs of our warming planet.
It's happening at night, too. The National Weather Service says overnight lows in many places are expected to only get down to the upper 70s or lower 80s. That could break dozens of overnight temperature records. Experts are urging people to take care. Cities are opening cooling centers, advising people to stay indoors, and extending hours for public swimming pools. Another concern? Strained power grids, which could leave many without air conditioning. Also, overwhelmed emergency rooms. Experts say communities will need to get used to planning for all these things as the warming climate makes heat waves like this one more common. I'm Mose Bushell in Austin.
Governor Greg Abbott sent a letter to district and county attorneys across the state this week dismissing the idea that recently passed legislation inadvertently decriminalized marijuana statewide. KUT's Jerry Quijano explains.
The bill that legalized hemp in Texas established a limit of 0.3% THC, the psychoactive component of marijuana. After it became law, DAs in some of the state's most populous counties stopped prosecuting low-level marijuana cases, arguing that they did not have the testing equipment to differentiate hemp from marijuana. But the letter signed by Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Attorney General Ken Paxton, and Speaker Dennis Bonin says these dismissals, quote, cannot be blamed on legislation that did not decriminalize marijuana in Texas, end quote. The letter points out language in the bill stipulating that anyone transporting hemp needs a certificate and argues this gives attorneys another tool to prosecute these cases. Jerry Quijano, KUT News.
Travis County Attorney David Escamilla is responsible for prosecuting misdemeanor marijuana possession cases.
Well, they haven't promulgated the rules yet. So for now, what he said is, so they say we've added another offense. Yes, another offense that's not ripe, and it's still not possession of marijuana. All we've spoken to is possession of marijuana. And by the way, the violation of those rules, my understanding, is a Class C misdemeanor. So, you know, they're not necessarily being so straightforward about it. Now, I'll tell you, it disappointed me that the letter to us did not acknowledge their responsibility for being asleep at the switch by allowing passage and signing of such a flawed bill. I don't think any of them have any experience with prosecuting marijuana cases before a jury, and especially in Travis County. I think what you're going to see is jurors are going to have an expectation of having a lab report. So these magical cases that are going to present themselves without having a lab report are kind of silly. It's going to take a great deal more work, and the expectations of the juries are going to be, where's the lab report?
Escamilla says his policy has not changed and they will not prosecute marijuana possession cases without a lab report. Home prices in the Austin metro area have surged to new heights since the economic recession nearly a decade ago. KUT's Nadia Hamdan has more on the latest home sales report out this week from Adam Data Solutions.
The report shows the median price for a single-family home in the Austin area was 77% above its pre-recession peak in the second quarter of this year. For metro areas with more than a million people, that's the second highest increase in the country behind Denver. On Wednesday, the Austin Board of Realtors underscored how much Austin home prices have recovered. It reported median single-family home prices in Austin hit an all-time high last month of $420,000. That's up 10% compared to June of last year. Other Texas metros that have shown strong gains since their pre-recession peaks include San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Houston. Nadia Hamdan, KUT News.
You may start seeing more buskers in downtown Austin because of what the city council did on homelessness. The Austin City Council last month voted to scale back restrictions on camping, panhandling, and sitting or lying down in public. And Chad Switecki, with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, has looked at what this could mean for musicians who play unamplified music for tips in public spaces. Chad joins us from South Austin. Hello, Chad.
Hi, Nathan.
Can you remind us what the legal situation has been for buskers in Austin?
It's been, I guess, cloudy or shifting is probably maybe a better word for it. So our good old First Amendment for years and years and years has given street musicians the right to perform kind of wherever they want to in public spaces. The hiccup with Austin being that the solicitation and panhandling ordinances prevented you from dropping your hat and asking for tips, as is kind of a practice in many other cities and places and somewhat celebrated. Every couple of years, you would have musicians popping up at the Music Commission meetings complaining that they had been shoved along or cited by police officers for performing in public, even though that part of it was legal, but it was the asking for money that created the problem. And so anytime that music commissioners or anyone else really would try to either get clarity or fix the situation, the roadblock they kept running into was that the city's legal interpretation of its soliciting ordinance technically made that practice a no-go.
So Austin City Council members, they said, voted to decriminalize homelessness by scaling back those restrictions on solicitation. So what will that mean for buskers?
By every interpretation now, it seems like that busking is now legal. This is kind of a thing that happened while no one was looking. Right. And when we checked into it, just offhand, like, huh, I wonder what this means. The kind of not enthusiastic, but at least, yeah, this is what appears to be the case now. You know, provided musicians are obeying the noise ordinance, you're good. So go ahead, drop the hat, play your kazoo, your hand drum, your guitar, and you're off to the races making buckets of cash.
You linked to the noise ordinance in your story, and I just want to read some of that to give an idea of what this rule actually says. It's in the city code, and it says, in part, a person may not make noise or play a musical instrument audible to an adjacent business or residence between the hours of 10:30 p.m. and 7 a.m. And it seems like that is probably the crux of the rule that's still in effect.
Yeah, exactly. So daytime, you know, up until 10:30, you're good to go. But after that, you have to, you know, obey some kind of quality of life expectations.
Is there any resistance to the idea of having more buskers in downtown Austin?
Well, we'll have to wait and see, right? This is a thing that hasn't really been widely disseminated yet. I mean, we've written about it, and right. I think word will slowly start to get out.
Why had there been such resistance to allowing busking in the live music capital of the world that it took an accidental act of the city council for there to be a policy allowing people to perform in public spaces for tips?
It's not like anyone seemed to have a vendetta against this practice, but it was just an interpretation of an ordinance by city legal that really was at best occasionally or very selectively enforced, but it did happen. This is an issue that, I mean, I've been attending Music Commission meetings for about the last 6 or 7 years, and it would pop up every year or two, at least, you know, that either someone from the music community or from a music commissioner themselves would kind of make it a thing and try to get this fixed. And then they'd quickly find out that they're, you know, running uphill in syrup and it would not go anywhere.
Chad Switecki is with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor. You can read his story at austinmonitor.com. It's called "By Decriminalizing Homelessness, Austin Stumbles Into Legalized Busking." Chad, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Nathan.
Capital Metro says more people are using public transit in the year since it launched its CAP remap program. But as KUT's Samuel King reports, officials say a new map is not the only thing driving increased ridership.
Cap Metro says ridership overall increased by 3.4%, bucking a national trend of declining ridership among transit agencies. Last June, the agency streamlined its bus routes and added more frequent service on 14 of them as part of its Cap Remap initiative. CEO Randy Clark says those changes, along with improved operations, is making the difference.
The reliability is better. The on-time performance, if you will, the speed of the service, safety, all those sort of things, people are now saying, oh, if I had a choice before, I may not, but now I really want to take transit.
Clark says Cap Metro is now working on adding more signage and shading to bus stops. While bus numbers are up, Metro Rail ridership has dropped by 36%. Clark says that was expected due to disruptions caused by track and station improvements. Samuel King, KUT News.
Texas officials have decided not to spend any money on the 2020 census, even though in the past 10 years, the population of Texas has grown massively. So business leaders, large cities, and even nonprofits in Texas say they're being forced to step in instead. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports.
The only state with more people than Texas is California. And just to compare, California plans to spend more than $150 million on the census. And that's why Ann Beeson, the CEO of the Center for Public Policy Priorities in Austin, says it's a big problem that Texas isn't spending a dime.
California is eating our lunch on the census. And what that's going to mean is more representation and more dollars for California than Texas.
And Texas's population isn't just big, it's booming. Many of the country's fastest growing cities are here. In fact, by some estimates, Texas is set to gain 3 to 4 congressional seats after the census. But that's only if there's an accurate count. And Beeson says a lot of the state's population is actually likely not to be counted.
Texas is already at a high risk of an undercount, and that is because we have a higher percentage of what are considered hard to count populations. And those include low-income people, they include immigrant families, they include young children. We have a particularly high risk of an undercount of young children because we have so many.
Beeson says there's research that shows a 1% undercount could cost Texas $300 million federal dollars a year. That's money that would pay for education, transportation, and healthcare programs, which is why local officials across the state say it's their job now to make sure people are getting counted.
Well, so much in the state of Texas relies on local government stepping up.
That's Bruce Elfant. He's the tax assessor and voter registrar for Travis County here in Austin. He's also a member of the city's Complete Count Committee, which is a group focused just on the census.
This is a time where local government's going to have to step up again, and I'm really proud of what we have here in Travis County.
Elfant says school districts and other municipal government, as well as local businesses, will have to pitch in. And nonprofits say they will too, says Stephanie Swanson with the Nonpartisan League of Women Voters of Texas.
We realized, and basically it was going to be up to us, and so now we will have to rely on our cities, and it will also fall on the shoulders of nonprofits and the community to get out the count basically now.
Swanson says she and others are trying to get nonprofits across the state, especially trusted community groups, to make this a priority. She says it's not going to be easy.
I think we have a lot of work that we have to do, and so we're still in the initial phases, and I'm not quite sure if that really has sunk in with a lot of the population here in Texas.
The biggest hurdle will be funding large-scale education programs, Swanson says. Texas has one of the largest immigrant populations in the country, and so talk of a possible citizenship question on the census has those communities particularly nervous about answering the census.
That's something that we're still struggling with, to find a good way to talk to people about it. We don't want to scare them, basically.
So far, the state's biggest cities, including Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, all have citywide efforts. Ann Beeson with the Center for Public Policy Priority says it's a good thing there are people starting to take this seriously. But she says, ideally, the whole state of Texas would have a plan to make sure that everyone here is counted.
And as a proud Texan, that kind of makes me mad. I mean, I feel like we need to kind of step up to the plate and really get on the ball and just make sure that we're getting counted just like those Californians are getting counted.
Beeson says one of the biggest reasons Texas officials should step up is that many rural counties in Texas probably won't have the resources big cities do to make sure their residents are counted next year. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Wendy Davis, the former state senator who unsuccessfully challenged Greg Abbott in the governor's race in 2014, appears to be getting ready to run for Congress in the 21st Congressional District. That district includes part of Austin and is currently held by Republican Chip Roy. He won the seat last year by less than 3 percentage points after Republican Lamar Smith resigned. The Texas Tribune reports House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is among the Democratic leaders who've invited people to meet with Wendy Davis next week in Washington, D.C. Tribune reporter Patrick Svitek has that story. Patrick, what can you tell us about this meeting next week in Washington?
So a number of U.S. House leaders, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are hosting an event Tuesday in Washington, D.C. for Wendy Davis. It's being advertised as a meeting in support of her campaign for Texas's 21st Congressional District. She is widely expected to run for that seat, which is currently held by Austin Republican Chip Roy, but she hasn't made a formal announcement yet. Nonetheless, this event, with all the kind of heavyweight Democratic support that's featured on it, shows that she is the kind of overwhelming choice of Washington Democrats and of a majority of Texas Democrats in the congressional delegation.
Texas Congressional District 21 has not been held by a Democrat since Bob Krueger in 1979. So what gives Democrats confidence that they might be able to win it in 2020?
What gives Democrats confidence that they can compete in this seat this cycle would probably at the very least be how well they did in this seat last cycle. The Democratic nominee last cycle, Joseph Kopser, came within 3 points of winning the seat, which, as you point out, is a traditionally Republican seat. It was an open seat last cycle. Lamar Smith, the Republican who held it for decades, literally had retired. And so it was an open seat. And so it was a little bit of a different dynamic. But Kopser, the Democratic nominee, nonetheless came pretty close for such a traditionally Republican district.
Can you explain to us, Patrick, why Wendy Davis is the preferred choice by so many Democrats to run in this congressional district?
You know, she is obviously one of the more prominent Democrats in Texas, especially after her tenure in the state Senate, where she represented Fort Worth, and then after her high-profile run for governor in 2014. She obviously came up very short in that run for governor in 2014, but she ran a pretty well-funded and spirited campaign across the state and got connected and got to know a lot of different Democrats. And especially in the area of this congressional district, which touches San Antonio and Austin, there's a lot of people in this district, you know, who are politically inclined, who remember her and are also familiar with what she's done to stay involved in politics since leaving the state Senate and since that gubernatorial race.
Patrick Svitek, reporter for the Texas Tribune. You can read his story about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other leaders in the House hosting an event for Wendy Davis as she considers a congressional run at texastribune.org. Patrick, thanks for coming on KUT.
Great. Thanks again for having me.
If you have a kid in the Austin Independent School District and you want to transfer them to another school, you are running out of time, my friend. The district will close its transfer window July 30th. KUT's Claire McInerney reports on what parents need to know before the deadline.
Parents can apply for a school transfer online or by visiting AISD headquarters downtown. Any family can apply, but not every school is open for transfers. These schools are closed to accepting students outside of attendance zones because each is already at student capacity. This year, those schools are Aikens, Austin, Bowie, Lanier, and McCallum High Schools, Fulmore, Lamar, Murkison, and Small Middle Schools, and Baldwin, Baranoff, Blazier, Brentwood, Cassis, Cowan, Doss, Gillette, Hill, Kiker, Maplewood, Menchaca, Oak Hill, Summit, and Zilker Elementaries. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
Representatives of the state's manufacturing and agricultural industries spent part of the week in Washington, D.C., urging the passage of the new United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, despite broad support, the reconfiguration of the old North American Free Trade Agreement still faces some political hurdles in the U.S. House.
Mexico is the number one trading partner for Texas businesses. In the decades after NAFTA, Texas companies built business models around free trade between the state and Mexico. Kelly Sullivan Georgiadis is a rancher in Crockett. She represented the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association at a House Joint Subcommittee meeting this week.
Prior to the USMCA, the NAFTA was wonderful for the beef industry, and that's what we want to see it ratified to be able to move forward and keep that duty-free access that we have for our beef.
She says her industry already lives with thin profit margins. Any impediment, like tariffs, would make beef production even more difficult. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi stated this week that she would like to see the USMCA pass, but with, quote, surgical changes. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
Almost everyone has an opinion about Austin's architecture, especially when it comes to the skyline, the skyscrapers. But there's one building that's attracted way more attention than any of the other recent additions to the city skyline. It led to a question for our AT Explained project that ended up bringing KUT's Matt Largie from the streets below to the highest point in the city.
On the morning I met Jonathan Murphy, it was pouring rain.
Oh, you have to go around to the other side, sorry.
So we're in my car parked at Auditorium Shores.
Good weather for it.
I'll say, yeah, yeah. Hey, I'm Matt.
Nice to meet you, Jonathan.
Good to meet you, too.
Through the windshield, we can see Austin's skyline. And right in front of us, one building in particular that Jonathan asked about for AT Explained.
So what are we looking at here? Can you kind of describe this?
We are looking at one of Austin's newest additions to its skyline. It's a big, tall building shaped a bit like a Jenga tower. It's the Independent.
If you've looked at downtown Austin lately, you've seen it. This weird stack of slightly offset blocks. Like he says, it looks like a big glass Jenga tower. It looks pretty cool if you ask me, but not everyone thinks so. And that's what led Jonathan to ask this question.
Why does Austin's tallest building look unfinished? And why is everyone so mad about it? There's petitions to have it changed. People are very angry. And I mean, this is Austin. People are usually angry about something, but this building has definitely got people up in arms.
What do you think it is about the building that people are so upset about?
If I had to guess, I think the specific problem is about the crown, or what they call the crown. But the very, very top of the building is this sort of netted, sort of meshed peak that seems to be kind of blocking something off and definitely looks distinct from the rest of the building.
Now, I've heard a lot of people say this, that the top of the building looks unfinished, like it was just tacked on to an otherwise beautiful building.
It's just such a strange choice that it's visible. I think whatever is up there, maybe we don't need to see, and so it's strange that they've left it so people can see it. There must be a reason behind it. I don't know what it is specifically, but there must be a reason.
We'll get to that reason in a minute. But first, why the heck are people so upset about it?
I live on South Lamar, just up from Zilker Park, so up and down South Lamar corridor, you can see it, like, perfectly framed.
This is Ben Anstead. I met him later at Auditorium Shores with a good view of the Independent.
And so it's just always right there, and every day in my commute, I'd be stuck in traffic and at the lights, and I'd be looking at it. And then they pulled the crane down, and I thought, wait a minute, there's still more to do.
Why is it so offensive to you?
You know, they went out of their way to build the tallest building in town by a couple of feet. They wrote media and press releases about rewriting the Austin skyline, and then it just, you know, womp womp.
Ben was so upset, he started an online petition under the banner Fix the Crown.
So is this petition serious? Like, are you serious about this?
It was very much kind of like a tongue-in-cheek. It was more of like an awareness thing because I talked to so many people casually in conversation. Everybody I spoke with thought it was finished. And because everybody thought it was finished, it was kind of like me saying, no, it's not. That's it. That's the final product.
So you don't expect them to actually do anything?
I don't expect them to actually do anything. I just, you know, I know overwhelmingly it seemed like people always agreed with me whenever I brought it up. So I just wanted to see if other people thought the same thing.
At last check, about 1,300 people have signed Ben's petition. So I guess that covers why some people are upset. So let's get to the other part of Jonathan's question.
Why does Austin's tallest building look unfinished?
Only one way to find out. I called the people who designed the building. Rohde Partners is the architecture firm based here in Austin. I got transferred to voicemail.
You've reached the desk of Sam Galfan. I'm unable to answer the phone right now. Please leave a message. I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks.
Hey, Sam. My name is Matt Largy. I'm a producer at KUT here in Austin, and I'm calling because we do this project where audience members send us questions. And I told him I want to learn a little more about what's at the top of the Independent and why it looks the way it does. And I honestly didn't expect to hear back.
Email me.
But hey,
it's Matt, maybe.
M-A-T-T at KUT.org. Thanks so much, Sam. Hope to hear from you soon. Okay, so while we're waiting to see if that goes anywhere, let's see here. Let's take a look around Austin's skyline.
I'll start here. You got Spring. Let's see.
This is James Rambin. He writes about skyscrapers and all kinds of development stuff for the Austin Towers blog. He knows all the buildings by name.
I think you can find at least one humanizing element to every building in our skyline. I think there's something interesting about every single one, and I like to find what that thing is. 500 West 2nd. North Shore.
I call James because he thinks a lot about what skyscrapers mean to a city like Austin.
I kind of enjoy looking at the skyline from the perspective of a person who just got here. I like to imagine all the things that I would take for granted about Austin's growth if I just got here yesterday. And that's kind of exciting to me because there have been people who, you know, bemoan the growth of Austin, but all this development, you know, other than the issues regarding traffic and housing costs and all that, have made the city a more interesting, diverse, you know, creative place. And so, in a way, I think those towers to me represent the addition of creativity, the transformation of Austin into a world-class city.
Hyatt Hotel Van Zandt.
But not everyone sees new buildings that way, especially ones like the Independent.
As the tallest skyscraper, it represents growth in this city, and so skyscrapers in general are signifiers of growth, the most visible. And so people tend to, I think, project some of their anxieties, insecurities, frustrations about Austin's growth onto buildings like this.
It's not hard to see how Austin's affordability and traffic problems have gotten worse as all these tall buildings have sprouted downtown.
It's a lot easier to blame them on big buildings than these abstract concepts. You know, we've seen this happen before in Austin. I think ever since somebody built a building over one story in Austin, somebody was there to complain about it.
And sometimes it's specifically about the tops of the buildings. The writer J. Frank Dobie reportedly said the top of the UT Tower looked like, in his words, a Greek outhouse. It was not a compliment. And then there's one of my favorite buildings, the Frostbank Tower. You know, the one with the glass peaks at the top.
You know, if you've been around long enough to remember when that was built, when it opened in 2004, you know, we think that's an iconic building now. But back then, it was not, you know, the praise for that building was not unified.
The late Statesman columnist John Kelso said it looked like a pair of nose hair trimmers. The Statesman's art critic wrote it could be in any city USA. This blew my mind. Objectively, the top of the Frost Tower is beautiful, maybe still the best thing on the skyline right now. So I called a guy who knows a little something about it.
Hello, this is Tehran.
Tehran Duda co-founded Duda Payne Architects. It's the firm that designed the Frostbank Tower.
I've heard probably as many positive things as I have heard negative things.
Duda says his firm built dozens of models of the top of the tower, but none of them were quite right. And then
one evening I went home and my daughter, who was 9 or 10 at the time, was building these little origami figures and flowers. And I said, could you build a larger one, smaller origami flower? And she did that, and I nested one inside of the other, and I said, this would make a really beautiful crown on top of this building.
For the record, Duda did not go to Rice University. He thinks the myth that the Frostbank Tower was designed to look like Rice's owl mascot is hilarious. As for the criticism, he's pretty unconcerned.
You know, if you think about any work of art, if it can have a reference of being more than one thing, I consider it a success. If you can label it as just being one thing, then it's just a one-liner.
My ears are popping, man.
Remember that message I left for the architects that designed the Independent? Well, I got an email back, and the founder of the firm, Brett Rohde, agreed to take me up to the roof to check it out.
Floor 58.
The roof is out this way. Whoa.
Here we are.
We're on the roof of the Independent.
Wow.
And, kind of walk
you can see for miles
way
up here. Outside on the roof, there are these huge metal beams that are part of the support system that keeps the building standing. In the center, a giant concrete block.
At the very top is our liquid tune damper tank.
A liquid tune damper tank. You see, in tall buildings like this, the wind blowing against the side of them causes the building to sway. It's normal, but not particularly comfortable if you're inside. So this tank is filled with water, and it kind of sloshes around in there as the building sways.
And that kind of slows down the movement.
Physics. I don't really get it either.
And it works the best at the very top of the building.
And this is the reason the top looks so different. Remember how our question asker, Jonathan, described it?
This sort of netted, sort of meshed peak that seems to be kind of blocking something off.
You know, we wanted to do something that gave away or kind of revealed a little bit about what was going on at the top rather than just sort of seal it up into some sort of kind of hermetic container that, you know, nobody knows, has any idea what's going on.
But it's more than just aesthetic. He says the woven metal fabric that surrounds the top of the building allows the wind to pass through so there isn't even more force pushing on it. So that's why it looks the way it does. But what does Brett make of the criticism of his creation?
It puzzled me at first. I thought, do people really care that much? And then I started to think, wow, this is really great that people really care, you know? As an architect, you know, we always kind of whine about how, you know, nobody appreciates our work. Nobody cares. But in this case, somebody cared, and a lot of people cared. And I think that is, in and of itself, that's a good thing.
So it doesn't feel bad to hear someone criticize your work?
I'd have to, you know, be honest with you and just sort of say, yes, it does. It does affect you. You do think about it. You stop and think, well, what? Let me try to, you know, understand what their point of view is. So in that sense, feel bad? No, maybe it's a little bit of a pause of reflection, if you will, to try to understand what that criticism is. And I've learned a lot from it. I have to tell you, I don't know that we would have done anything different here, but I think it's something that does make you pause.
In time, I bet people will come to love the Independent, just like they did the Frostbank Tower. And for the record, I think the Independent looks great just the way it is. But for those who disagree, you'll be pleased to hear that, in a sense, the top of the building actually isn't quite finished. Brett says they're adding lighting that can change colors, like the top of the Empire State Building. Look for that later this year. Matt Largy, KUT News.
There's more from our AT Explained project at atexplained.org. Subscribe to the podcast there or ask your own question. Might be the next one we answer. That's atexplained.org. That's KUT Weekend for the third weekend of July 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 at KUT.org.